This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It is good to be back after a case of laryngitis and a sore throat that lasted way too long. I want to thank Dave Davies for hosting during most of my absence and for being so good-natured about taking on Fresh Air in addition to his other work here at WHYY. And thanks to David Bianculli for hosting last Tuesday. Now on to today's show. My guest, J.J. Abrams, co-created the TV series Lost, Felicity, and Fringe, and created the series Alias. He directed the films Mission Impossible 3 and Star Trek. He wrote and directed the new film Super 8. It connects to his own childhood when he made horror films using a Super 8 camera, relying on family and friends as his actors, and creating his own special effects. Super 8 is set in 1979 in a small town in Ohio where six friends who are about 14 years old are making a zombie movie. They're about to shoot a scene at a train station where the husband is ready to depart, but his wife wants him to stay. As they prepare to shoot, they hear a real train in the distance. The film's director starts shouting for everyone to hurry and get ready so that they can shoot the scene with an actual train speeding by. But as you'll hear, something shocking happens.
Shut up! I'm
trying!
Get that set up!
Positions! Positions!
Ready. Start filming. Be extra loud when the train passes by. Here we go. And action!
John, I don't like it. This case, these murders.
What do you want me to do? Go to Michigan with you?
Mackinac Island's beautiful this time of year.
Well, that's the sounds of the train exploding. Why and how it explodes introduces the science fiction part of the story. It should come as no surprise that there is a sci-fi dimension. This is, after all, a J.J. Abrams production, and Steven Spielberg is one of the producers. J.J. Abrams, it's really a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
So the kids in your movie are making a zombie movie shot with a Super 8 camera. So before we go any further, please describe the Super 8 camera you had when you were a kid.
It was the camera that they are using in the film. It was a Umig camera that was a sound camera. And my grandfather bought it for me when I was around 13. And I really wanted to make sure that the camera that the kids were using in the movie was the same one.
So why did you want to make a movie about kids shooting a Super 8 film who happened to witness and catch on film something very bizarre?
The very first impulse here was just to do a movie about being a kid making movies, which is what I used to do. And before that idea was even formed that much, I picked up the phone and called Steven Spielberg, who I'd gotten to know over the years. And I asked him, would you be interested in being, you know, a producer with me on a movie called Super 8 about kids making movies? I knew he had made films when he was a kid as well. And it was just, he said yes, luckily. And it was the beginning of the sort of process of figuring out what this movie might be. But that was the impulse.
And of course, there had to be a supernatural or extraterrestrial dimension.
Well, you know, there didn't have to be, but it was one of those things where it started out, I actually thought it was going to be much more of a sort of straight drama comedy, you know, much more of a kind of Stand By Me type movie. And as we worked on the story, I felt that there was something missing. There was some kind of, you know, I needed something in the movie that would sort of be a physical manifestation of what the main character was going through, you know, internally, this sort of struggle, having lost his mother and being left with a father he never really connected with. And so there was a kind of need that I had, but separately, I'd had an idea about the U.S. Air Force moving Area 51 contents from Nevada to another destination, and the train crashes and something escapes, but I didn't have more than that, but there was a premise that I thought, oh, that's kind of a fun monster movie. And the idea of connecting these two movies, suddenly they started to answer each other's questions, and that was sort of how that began.
So when you were making Super 8 movies, what were the movies that you made? Were they zombie films like in your movie Super 8?
They were the worst. I mean, they were just these ridiculous, horrible. I mean, they were no good. I would take anyone who was available. My sister, my mother, any friends, and I would, kill them in crazy ways. We would do, makeup effects, and I wrote fan letters. When I was a kid, I used to write fan letters to like makeup artists whose, special effects makeup stuff blew my mind, like Dick Smith and, Rick Baker, Tom Savini, these guys who are sort of known for just incredible. Of course, as a kid, when you're 11, 12, 13, you can't do that. And they, but I would try. So I would take the Karo syrup and food coloring and stuff from the kitchen, and I would make blood, and I would, ask my mom if I could borrow her makeup, which, didn't trouble her because she knew that I was going to just kill someone, basically, with it. So it was just, it was all ridiculous.
So what was the strangest way you killed people in your movies?
Well, I mean, I remember there was a fight scene that I did where there were these two guys fighting at the films at UCLA at a parking structure, and there were these two guys fighting, and one guy gets kind of flipped over the railing on like the fifth floor, and he's holding onto the railing, and these guys are fighting, and the guy didn't die in the I don't actually remember how that incredibly exciting cliffhanger ends, but I remember my father watching this. I was editing the movie, and he came into my room, and I was watching the scene, and he literally got angry at me that I would risk someone's life for a scene in the movie. Now, it was the greatest victory because it was a dummy, and I'd rigged it with like wires so the legs were kicking and all this. And he left the room like really pissed, and I was just I was so happy that he believed it. And it literally just speaks to that desperate desire as like a little fat magician kid, wanting your family to believe that little, foam yellow rabbit just disappeared from your hand or whatever. It's that same thing of just all you want is for people to believe it.
And did you tell him finally that it was a dummy and that you weren't really risking someone's life?
Yeah, and then I think he got mad because I think he felt like he was, he's embarrassed. No, it was all good. It was one of those things where when I did finally tell him, he was like, well, okay, but it was great because it actually showed that these three cuts, by having the two guys on the ground floor and flipping over the side, but then looking up to the fifth floor, it looked like they had flipped over. It was all that kind of stuff that is pretty, fundamental movie-making stuff. But it was those kind of things. I had friends come over, and we would, I would do all sorts of we'd make sets in rooms. Like, I'd take all the furniture out of my room, and I would, put, like, black crate paper on the wall, and all this crazy stuff. My parents would come home, and all the furniture would be in the hallway, and they'd be like, "The hell's going on here?" It was always like some ridiculous thing that we were doing.
And the black crate paper was for.
It was like I was making. It was a film, Terry, called The Attic, and it was just so good. And there was a scene in it where one of the kids says, "Oh, I didn't even know he had an attic." It's one of the, and actually Greg Grunberg, who's one of my best friends since kindergarten. I've known him forever. He's been in a lot of TV shows that I've done, and it was on Heroes. He was in that movie. And so what I did is I took all the furniture out. This is such a good story. You're not going to believe it. And I'm, of course, being sarcastic. All the furniture out of the room, put black crepe paper on the wall, and then put, like wood, like contact paper, looked like wood paneling, classic 70s, beautiful contact paper, and made it look like there was an attic, basically, in the room. Like, there was, like, the beams, the cross beams. And it was just this set, which actually for one angle functioned fairly well, but these were all just experiments of things to try and create an illusion of something that I wanted to do.
My guest is J.J. Abrams, the co-creator of Lost. His new movie is called Super 8. Now, there is an element, I'm trying not to give away a lot of the more supernatural or, stop me if I'm making you real uncomfortable with what I'm giving away here, but I won't say much. But most of your stories have an element of either the supernatural, the inconceivable, aliens, all of the above. Is that just because of the influence of TV, movies, books that you loved? Or did you ever have the kind of experience that seemed, implausible and impossible and only had, a supernatural explanation?
It's a funny thing. I remember as a kid just being in absolute tears over the Charles Laughton Hunchback of Notre Dame.
That is one of my favorite films ever made.
Me too. It is literally this defining movie for me, and it was just killed me. And the idea of this misunderstood, you know, huge-hearted, you know, seeming monster to strangers. And it was the idea of that love story was so profound. And I was aware...
Because there's a gypsy dancer who has compassion for him when everyone else just sees him as a deformed monstrosity.
Exactly. And the idea of not just that kind of love, but the idea that it was, you know, a movie that used makeup effects. It was a movie that used, there were visual effects. It was an incredible thing. They shot it at, you know, at Universal Studios. But the idea of that movie was so profound to me. And I loved that notion that you could combine something that was monstrous. And I think, you know, as a kid, you know, whether you're watching, you know, Batman and people are dressing up in, you know, costumes, or you're, you know, you're watching cartoons, or you go to see movies. I mean, there's something about monsters that I think kids always, you know, are drawn to and curious about. I always love that idea of combining that kind of emotion with something that was so, you know, kind of like horrific or scary, or, you know, literally an effect, a makeup effect. And so whether it was that or you know, Frankenstein, I mean, The Elephant Man years later, which I just...
Oh,
you know,
what a great
feel
film.
The same way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. So the idea of using, you know, visual effects, whether they be makeup effects or now, you know, CG effects, to convey an emotional story was something that was really important to me. And Super 8, you know, while, you know, obviously, like, you know, like anything, it's like there are, you know, there are, it's imperfect, and there are things that don't work, you know, here and there as well as I would have liked, and all that. You know, you always look back and think, oh, I wish this, I wish that. But the thing that I'm the most, you know, sort of, that was most important to me, at least going in, the ambition was to create something that had, yes, it had a creature, but more important to me was that it was something that had feeling and had heart.
And you mentioned the creature, and the creature is seen as, like, very monstrous, and it is very destructive, but it's also misunderstood. And like in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, once you know what the story is, you have empathy for
yes.
it. So can we talk a little about, without giving away too much,
sure.
what you are up against in designing a creature?
You know, the struggle, you know, you look at one of the recent Star Wars movies and you realize that every single creature in the history of time has been done. Like, there's just,
right.
you know, you can't, it's all been done. And all the paradigms, you know, what color is a creature? How many legs does the creature have? How many are, you know, how, like, are the eyes, where are the eyes? You know, what's gonna, you know, is it a biped, quadruped? Like, you know, there are these kind of categories and they've all been completely covered. And so working on this creature, it was important to me that it be not just a sort of raving beast, chest-thumping, you know, scary thing, that it needed to also be, you know, sentient and dexterous and you know, thoughtful and nuanced and yet also just out-and-out terrifying. So it was this thing of trying to figure out what is something that could be hard to define for most of the movie so that you don't ever feel like, oh, I get it, I got it. But the designer of the creature, Neville Page, did an amazing job, and I think he gave us something that it took a ton of iterations, but he really nailed it. And, you know, I'm really proud of how ILM brought it to life.
So one of the things you're famous for is trying to keep the story's plot, the plot twists, a secret, particularly on things like Lost. But in this movie, too, I've read so much about how, you know, you're trying to keep everything a secret. How obsessive are you about that, really?
About 15 years ago or so, I wrote a script for a Superman film. And it was leaked out of the studio at Warner Brothers, and someone reviewed the script online in great detail, and it became this big thing. And ultimately, the film didn't get made. I'm sure not just because of the review, but because of any number of things. But it was one of those things where to have a script that is nowhere near the latest draft, let alone the final draft, being reviewed online, it frankly made me, you know, a little bit paranoid, and I realized, you know, all they had to do was not give the script out to everyone. All they had to do was take a few, you know, steps, and something that was, I know, very important to the studio and to the filmmakers, you know, wouldn't have been released prematurely, of course, you know, you never want a script to be reviewed before the movie even gets made. The point is, I guess, that there are certain things that I think are important to kind of keep quiet. And yet I think, frankly, this whole secrecy thing has kind of been blown a little bit out of proportion. On Star Trek, we had a lot of rabid fans. We just were trying to kind of protect the experience for them. But I don't know how many times I've gone to the theater, to the movies, and seen a trailer and felt like, all right, well, now I certainly don't have to see the movie anymore because I just saw everything. And the experience of going to a film and seeing the movie and not knowing every plot twist, to me, is something that has been ruined and spoiled for moviegoers. And I certainly don't want to be coy and be some kind of jerk and, you know, be withholding and some kind of, you know, it's not a Machiavellian sort of thing. It's literally wanting people to have a good time and to have a little bit of a surprising time. And so whenever I'm trying to keep things quiet, it is 100% an effort to make the experience of actually seeing the movie or the TV show more enjoyable for the viewers.
Now, we talked before about how when you were a kid and you made Super 8 films and you used special effects makeup and, killed your characters off in all kinds of creative ways. One of the kids in the film loves making things blow up, and he always has firecrackers on him and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Are you into pyrotechnics, and what was it like to direct this multi-explosion scene?
I was, you know, as a kid, I would make models and I would film them as I blew them up. I mean, that was, I wouldn't say a hobby, but it was one of the things I would try to do. Of course, you know, you didn't have the lenses to get the shot quite right, and you didn't have slow motion. So, you know, when you watch the movie, it was always over in like 4 milliseconds. Like, you're like, what? You know, you'd spent hours doing this whole thing, and you get it back. You're like, you know, you're watching it, and it's like, it's over instantly. And you just think that was the biggest waste of an afternoon. So these kids, directing these kids in that experience, all I cared about was obviously that they were safe. And secondly, I wanted them to, you know, be scared. They had to pace themselves because they had to be just terrified out of their minds for, you know,
Did you
four
want
days.
The actual act kids to be scared or the kids to look scared?
Yeah. Well, I wanted the kids to look scared. I mean, yeah. I never wanted them to actually be scared.
Okay.
And, you know, the whole thing for me with these kids was always that they feel safe so that they could be free to do the things that they might just do in the privacy of their room. You know what I mean? Like act out and do certain things. I needed them to feel like anything was okay. And I never wanted to play tricks on them. It was funny that I was freaking out just as a sidebar. The first couple days of shooting, frankly, I didn't know if it was going to work. And we had, you know, Joel, the main kid, and Riley, and they were nervous. And I was probably more nervous than they were, but they were really nervous. And I just really
because of the explosives.
Oh. No. This was like school's out, and it was just early days of shooting.
We
were at the train crash. Sorry. And they, I really thought, oh my god, this is I don't know if this is gonna work. And I was in a panic, and I called my wife. I'm like, I don't know if this is gonna work. And I, emailed Steven. I'm like, I'm terrified. And we did 30 takes of something. And he's like, he sends me back an email. 30's a lot. And I remember I was just freaking out. And I called Rob Reiner, who had directed, Stand By Me.
Mm-hmm.
And I called, him. And I said, Rob, I'm working with these kids. I'm trying to be calm. I'm working with these kids. It's all fine. But I just want to know, do you have any advice? Whatever. He's like, well, do you trust them? They have good instincts. I'm like, I think they do, but can you just give me some advice, just something? Can you just tell me something? He's like, I was an actor. We had 3 months of acting school. I worked with them. They were fantastic. He wasn't helpful at all. But what he did say to me, though, was when he was filming the scene, the train scene, they wouldn't get riled up in Stand By Me. They wouldn't get to that place. And finally, he yelled at them, and he just said, this whole crew, everyone here, they're working for you, and you can't, you're not able to get. And he literally got them to a place where they were crying. And he just said that, maybe sometimes you got to pull that out of your pocket and sort of use that. And I never had to use it. But the filming of the train crash in Super 8 was really the most fun I think these kids ever had. Every time we'd do a shot, they would immediately after I said cut say, please, one more time. And they were just so into running with these huge explosions happening, hundreds of yards away from them.
Right at the beginning of the movie, one of the main characters, one of the kids' mothers, dies in an accident at work. And so one of his friends, I think it's the friend who's actually directing the Super 8 movie,
mm-hmm.
Some of the kids are talking to each other and they're saying, will he really want to make a zombie movie now that his mother's died? You know, will that be right? And yes, he still wants to make the movie, but, you know, the zombie movie's about the living dead, and he has a mother who is now really dead. And that led me to wonder, like, when you were young and you were into, you know, all the special effects and blood and gore and stuff, had you witnessed real blood? Had you experienced real death?
You know, as a kid, I think because I didn't really go through anything like this, it was safe to play in that. And it was something that was kind of terrifying and you know, provocative and interesting, and because it wasn't real, it was something that was safe. And so as a kid, the idea that you know, these horror films where, you know, as I just remember seeing the most ridiculous, horrific, gruesome, sometimes horribly executed, by the way, deaths in movies. But at the time, it was sort of a way to kind of, you know, I don't know, play with that idea of death. And I remember I was, I think I was 12, or maybe I was 14, and I got, I came home one day, and there was a box, a little teeny box, and it said Dick Smith on the, you know, from Larchmont, New York, on the postmark, and I opened up the box, and there was a tongue in the box. And it was a tongue from The Exorcist, which he had done. And it was, and he had this little handwritten note, I still have it, that said, put a little dab of peanut butter in the tongue and it'll stick in your, you know, stay there. And it's what Linda Blair wore in one of the scenes where she had to stick her tongue out. It had to be like, you know, 4 or 5 inches longer. My mom came home. She's like, what's that? I'm like, oh, it's a tongue that Dick Smith, you know. She's like, what man sent you a tongue? What's going on? Like, it was like, didn't seem like a good thing for her kid to be doing, you know. So the answer to the question, you know, did I experience death? Did I see death? You know, I did not in that way, but it was like all around me and all the stuff that I was, you know, interested in. And I think as you get older, it's far less fun, that kind of stuff. I mean, I am no longer in any way a fan of those kind of movies. And have actually not seen for, you know, I don't even know how many years, movies that are of that genre, that kind of, like, you know, that sort of torture porn, horrific, ultra-violent movie. You know, I used to love those movies as a kid. And now, of course, having 3 kids, those films are repulsive to me. And yet, I'm, you know, amazed and applaud the work of the artists who create the illusions of those movies.
But let me ask you this, like, when you would pass a car accident when you were young, would you look or not look?
You know, it's a funny thing. I've always been interested in that stuff, but, you know, I think when you're actually confronted with the real deal, it changes everything. I wrote this movie years ago. I was writing it called Regarding Henry, and there was a character who gets shot in the head and survives. And I was actually interested in seeing a brain surgery, and I called a cousin in our family who's a doctor, and I asked him if he knew of any way I could get in to see an operation, a brain surgery, and he said, well, let me see. And anyway, 5 years later, I swear to God, he calls me. He's like, do someone go see the brain surgery? I'm like, what? I had no idea. I was like, oh, yeah, sure. That next morning, 5 a.m., go down to USC, and there was a woman who had a tumor on her pituitary gland, and it was being removed. And we are in this, you know, operating room, and right there watching this woman. And they go to put the anesthesiologist comes over and he puts the mask over her face, and they're talking to her, and she's going under. And literally the promise of what was to come, like, turned my stomach. Like, even the promise of what was going to come next. It was an interesting thing, because, I mean, this was the kind of thing that I had been obsessed with as a kid, and would, you know, put Dermawax on, you know, my sister's face, and then, you know, cut it with a little, you know, wooden dowel and put blood inside. You know, I would do these kind of cuts all the time. And I left the room for a minute, and I was like, holy, like, this is really, you know. And I went back inside, and I watched as they did this amazing thing, which is, they, once she was under, they opened her mouth and they cut above her gum line above her teeth, her upper teeth. And they did this insane thing, which was just directly out of any of those makeup magazines that I would have read as a kid. And they pulled her mouth open past the nasal cavity. And they went in through the nasal cavity to remove this tumor, which they did. And they sewed her up. But it was this amazing thing to watch. And, you know, again, obviously being privileged to sort of be witness to a miracle like that, to see what doctors can do is incredible. But it was an amazing thing to see for real something that had been, you know, play for essentially my whole childhood.
And did that have an effect on you in terms of showing gore?
Doing a movie that was a truly gory movie hasn't really interested me. I mean, it's not that I'm opposed to it, and I'm you know, a big fan of directors like David Cronenberg and some of the work that they've done showing just crazy, horrific things. And I love, for example, John Carpenter's The Thing, the work that Rob Bottin did on the effects of that movie are just amazing. But the idea of doing a horror film or a slasher movie or something that's too overtly gory doesn't appeal to me. I remember when we were doing the pilot for Lost, there was this big plane crash, and I knew there was one moment I really wanted to have an impact, which is when they were pulling a guy out from under this sort of engine cowling, and you see his leg and how bloody it is. And so what occurred to me was to have no red at all in the scene, so that I didn't want the plane to have any red in its logo. I didn't want to have any red on the, you know, the wardrobe. I didn't want to have, there was a little bit of blood here and there, but I wanted to keep it really about sort of dirt and sand and, you know, just the mess of this crash. And so that when they pull him out and you see blood, it has an impact and it really stands out. And it's interesting. I've seen the pilot at least years ago with like full audiences at a couple screenings, and the reactions that they've had, like the communal immediate repulsive reaction to the blood, and all it really was blood, like fake blood poured on the guys. You weren't seeing bone stick. It wasn't anything crazy, but it was such an interesting thing, and I think that it spoke of how we become desensitized to that stuff. And so it's a little bit to me is a far more effective tool, and it doesn't feel disgusting and gratuitous, and I just have no interest in that stuff.
Okay, while we're on the subject of the pilot of Lost, or the first episode, you know, so that scene you're describing, it's not just, it doesn't look just like blood, it looks kind of like something you'd see in a butcher shop, you know?
Yeah, it was probably because it was on his clothes, too, you know, on his pants.
And then, like, within just a few seconds, you see that leg, and then a woman is kind of crawling to the shore, shrieking, because mm-hmm. she's, like, 9 months pregnant, and she's starting to mm-hmm. have contractions. And one guy is sucked into one of the jet engines of the crash plane, and he's kind of yeah. totally sucked into it, and that makes the whole engine explode. It's like, it's yeah. just all in a few seconds. It's
right.
it's so much. It almost verges on funny. It's so much.
I don't. But first of all, it's exactly right. And the idea of that guy getting sucked into the engine, though it was never meant to be like, you know, a laugh, it was meant to be a kind of, oh my God, this is insane kind of feeling, like
right.
where it was almost like a circus of horrors. And the idea of, you know, the subjective experience of that character, Matthew Fox was playing Jack, and his experience in that was really about just how this guy is, you know, he needs to be 10 places at once. And then, of course, the engine gag was really about kind of just how frightening this airplane, that it was, you know, the monster had fallen but hadn't died yet, and that there was still some danger left in it. And it just was about, you know, what would you do if you were surrounded by that kind of madness? And that was the reason we went so far.
Although the film Super 8 is set in a small town in Ohio, you grew up in Manhattan?
Yes, I was born in New York, but I was raised in L.A.
Okay. And in fact, your father was a producer of several movies and TV shows.
Yeah, he still actually is produces TV movies, and my mother actually produced a couple as well.
So you got to spend some time on the set at Paramount, was it?
He had an office at Paramount, but there were any number of TV movies that were being filmed, and I would visit the set, and I was very lucky to get to, you know, as a kid, watch the process and see how movies got made, and it was enormously informative.
So what's one of the things you learned watching on the set of one of the films that your father got you into as a child?
One of the biggest lessons actually came from a movie that he didn't have anything to do with. But one night I was, I guess I was like 15 years old. And one night my dad said, I want to take you somewhere. And we drove to Paramount Studios where he'd had an office. And we got to the small theater at Paramount. And we get there and there are probably 20 people there, 22 people in this theater. And I recognize one of the people there is John Carpenter. And he's a director who had done Halloween and The Fog and
Escape from New York. Yeah.
Well, this was the movie he was going to show.
Oh.
And he announced that, you know, what we're about to see is an incredibly rough cut of Escape from New York with none of the visual effects at all, no special effects, with a lot of the sound missing. He's like, I'm going to be reading a lot of the lines that aren't on the soundtrack. I was stunned. My mouth hit the floor, you know. I couldn't believe that I was in this small theater with this director who my father knew I admired so much. So I'm sitting there in this theater, and John Carpenter starts this film, and there was a whole opening sequence where the main character, Snake Plissken, is robbing a bank, and he ends up getting caught, and the movie plays, and the whole thing was magical. Like, it was amazing. And the movie was over, and John Carpenter said, you know, okay, I want to talk about the movie. And what I learned was just by watching him be open to any criticism. And it was just incredible watching him take notes that were sometimes easy and understandable, other times huge. And he knew he had a movie that at the time was problematic in certain ways, and he was trying to fix it. And I remember my dad raised his hand. I was like, oh, God, what? And he said, yes, you know, you. And my dad said, cut the opening from the movie. And I thought, I'm leaving. I am now so mad that I'm here. I'm so humiliated. And John Carpenter said, what do you mean? And my dad said, Snake Plissken is a more imposing character. He's more of a mythic character. If you don't see him get caught, but when you meet him, he's already held and you know. And I thought, this is the dumbest thing I ever heard. God, I wish he hadn't said that. And in the final movie, John Carpenter cut it out. And that whole sequence is not in the film. The other thing that was interesting is I remember I finally had the guts to raise my hand. And I said, and he said, yes, you, husky kid in the back. Like it was. And I said, I couldn't tell that this one character that Adrienne Barbeau, who was his wife at the time, played. I couldn't tell that she died when she, in this crash on the bridge. And they said, oh, interesting, that's interesting, you know. And anyway, years later, so I see the movie. The movie came out later that year, and not only was that opening scene gone, but there was a shot of Adrienne Barbeau dead on the ground after she was killed. And I was like, oh, my God, that's cool they put that in. Years later, I was working for Steven Spielberg doing a couple weeks' work on a script for this movie they were doing. And Dean Cundey was the DP, and he was also the director of photography of Escape from New York. And I went up to him and I said, excuse me, Mr. Cundey, my name's J.J. Abrams. I said, you know, I'm a big fan. And, it's funny because I was at the screening of Escape from New York at Paramount years ago when I was describing. He said, oh, no, I totally remember that night. And I remember a kid in the back saying that. And he said, the next night we went out onto John Carpenter's driveway and shot Adrienne Barbeau dead on the ground because we realized people needed to see that she actually had been killed. So that was hopefully not the last time I've collaborated with John Carpenter, but certainly the first.
So one more thing. One of the things you're famous for is the mystery box. You gave a great TED lecture, and those TED lectures are lectures of, you know, like incredibly creative, genius people. And so yours was like...
And me.
Yeah, and you, right. And yours was like really funny and entertaining and very kind of informative about your process of thinking through movies. And one of the centerpieces of it is you talking about this mystery box that you bought at this magic shop in Manhattan. And it was like a $15 box in which you were supposed to get $50 worth of magic stuff. But you've had the box for decades and you've never, ever opened it because what you love is the mystery. And you didn't want to open it and see what was really inside. So I imagine it's still unopened.
It's unopened, yes.
Yes. Now, for me, things like that are always about disappointment because like if you open them, what they've given you is actually probably really disappointing. It just reminds me this is really different. But like when you buy Cracker Jacks back in the old days and there'd be like a surprise inside and the surprise would always be this like cheap little piece of junky thing. It would be like nothing. And so a lot of those like surprise mystery kind of things, if you do open it, it's just going to be disappointment. So are you protecting yourself from disappointment or just in love with the mystery that if it was solved might be disappointing?
You know, I think it's a great question. I think the answer is a sort of combination of things. I think clearly I know, having gone through my share of Cracker Jack, and when I tell you, that I know that I open that magic mystery box and there's no way it's going to be, you know, something that is satisfying. In fact, I will tell you, that is the key to magic itself. The magic mystery box for me, of course I know that whatever it is inside can't be the, you know, the end all. But there's something about, first of all, the box remaining closed that, you know, just literally, even just aesthetically, I loved that box. There was a really cool question mark on it. But for me, the thing is that box, with it closed, the potential for what is inside is endless. The possibility of what might be in that box. And it's not a literal thing where I actually feel like, well, maybe it's this great. It's all kind of this metaphor. For me, the thing that I love, and I've talked about this as well, but, you know, in a movie like, you know, Jaws, like famously, the shark wasn't working, so they couldn't show it very much. So your imagination is going crazy, sort of imagining where it might be, what exactly does it look like. In a movie like The Graduate, Ben and Elaine have their first real date, and they're, you know, sitting at a restaurant eating in his convertible car, and people are being very loud, and they put the top up. And they're having this conversation, and you can't hear it, but you're watching it. So you get to sort of, you know, fill in the blanks. And I think there is a sort of almost a reflexive reaction that we have to fill the blanks in. When there's something of some substance and pieces are missing, you sort of fill it in. I think there's something about the unseen and the unknown that has real value in moments. But I do think that, you know, you can't apply a magic box approach to everything. And if you go to see a movie or if you watch a show, you better have something of substance that you're building to. The whole thing in itself can't be a magic box. The magic box is a great sort of device to kind of enhance a moment to make something more frightening or romantic or mysterious. But as an end, it must be serving something of value and of substance.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, J.J. Abrams. Thank you. It's been really fun.
It's been such a pleasure. It's been a blast. Thank you so much, Terry.
J.J. Abrams wrote and directed the new film Super 8. He's the producer of two upcoming TV pilots, Alcatraz on Fox TV and Person of Interest on CBS. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews Ron Hansen's new novel, A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion, about an infamous real-life crime of sexual transgression. This is Fresh Air. Award-winning writer Ron Hansen is particularly known for his historical novels, such as Marriott in Ecstasy and The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was adapted into a film starring Brad Pitt. Hansen's latest novel, A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion, is about an infamous crime of sexual transgression. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
Lust makes people do crazy things, as demonstrated by the almost weekly addition of yet another politician to our national walk of shame. But bad as the marital infidelities and lewd twitterings of our elected officials may be, there's cold comfort to be found in the fact that none of them have gone completely over the edge. In fact, if I had any pity for Schwarzenegger, Edwards, Wiener, and company, I'd recommend that, in their exile, they might want to read Ron Hansen's new novel about the real-life Ruth Snyder murder case, just to see how much worse things can get when the libido goes homicidally haywire. Hansen's latest is called A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion, and its story weds two of his fascinations as a novelist, the strange mutations of desire, which he explored in Mariette in Ecstasy, and the inner life of outlaws, most notably Jesse James. As its overheated title suggests, a wild surge of guilty passion delves deep into the hormonally saturated psyches of two people driven by desire to commit what was called in 1927 the crime of the century. In Hansen's version of the tale, Queen's housewife and mother, Ruth Snyder, was a voluptuous Jean Harlow blonde, antsy to escape a flat marriage. On a shopping trip into Manhattan, Ruth meets a traveling lingerie salesman named Judd Gray. Despite his racy job, the married Judd is rather repressed. That is, until Ruth introduces him to the romping delights of sin. For months, they sneak away for trysts in the Waldorf Astoria and to less elegant hotels in places like Buffalo and Scranton along Judd's sales route. But Ruth wants more. She wants hubby Al to do the 23 skidoo permanently. After taking out extra life insurance on the unsuspecting Al, Ruth makes a number of almost vaudevillian attempts to kill him by gas and poison. Nothing works until the night that Judd garrots Al with wire. Ruth tells the police that a couple of giant Italian burglars were the culprits, but that story is as flimsy as the lingerie Judd peddles. Soon, the two are on trial for murder, and the 11 newspapers then in circulation in New York City have a ball relaying all the salacious details about the Viking vampire, as they called the Nordic Ruth, and her stooge of a sex-addled boyfriend. If this all sounds a bit familiar, blame James M. Cain, who mined the Snyder case for both Double Indemnity and The Postman Always Rings Twice. Given Cain's classic novels, the immortal films noir that were made from them, and the many other books, including Snyder's and Gray's own jailhouse memoirs that have been written about this quintessential tawdry tabloid crime, the question arises, do we really need Hansen's novel? I'd vote yes, with qualifications. If I had to put only one creative retelling of the Snyder case in a time capsule, it would be Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. Barbara Stanwyck defines femme fatale in that movie. What a wild surge of guilty passion contributes to the Snyder canon is, first of all, a deliciously tangible appreciation of how the giddy sexual and commercial spirit of the Roaring Twenties were linked. Hansen delights in festooning his novel with all manner of period places and products, which somehow heighten the 20s devil-may-care social mores, hosiery shops and riotous smorgasbord restaurants, Wrigley chewing gum, Helena Rubinstein lipsticks, and Mavis talcum powder. Even more dazzling is Hansen's rendering of Judd's besottedness with Ruth. I can't quote the relevant carnal passages on the radio, but they sizzle. Even as he knows he's being played, Judd is too weak in the knees to ever attempt the return trip back to wife and family. Hansen follows the story to its fated conclusion, the 1928 death by electrocution of Judd and Ruth for the murder of her husband. Tabloid photographs of Ruth Snyder, most of them taken during her imprisonment, don't show her to be the knockout or wowser she was supposed to be. Hansen's account remedies that, however, by conjuring up Ruth's dark eroticism and the way it whispered to a man that sex was worth any sacrifice.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Wild Surge of Guilty Passion by Ron Hansen. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.